Omaha Public Radio presents another lecture program from the Center for Faith Studies on Noon Forum. We'll hear a talk by Nadia Bowles Weber, the founding pastor of House for All Sinners and Saints in Denver, Colorado, and author of Salvation on the Small Screen, 24 Hours of Christian Television. The topic of her talk, also the title of her latest book, is Pastrix, The Cranky, Beautiful Faith of a Sinner and Saint. This program was recorded by Omaha Public Radio on Thursday evening, February 27, 2014, for broadcast at this time. The opinions expressed are those of the speaker and do not necessarily represent those of the Center for Faith Studies, KIOS-FM, or the Omaha Public School District. Here now to introduce the program is Leslie Morrell, former interim director of the Center for Faith Studies.
The Center for Faith Studies at Countryside Community Church seeks out forceful speakers who are committed to the issues they address, offering balance over a range of the programs rather than within each presentation. With that in mind, our speaker obviously meets all that criteria. I met our speaker at the Wild Goose Festival. A fellow six-footer, I was starstruck by her uber coolness. One of my favorite hobbies is tattoo gawking. So it got pretty weird, pretty fast, serving her coffee under the Darkwood Brew tent. I managed to read her bio and caught one of her talks at the festival without creeping her out any further, so that's good, I guess. It was when I read her book, Pastrix, that it occurred to me how few differences we actually have and how similar walks in one way or another we've been on. Her beautiful book had me nodding with tears of humility and humbled and educated me on what grace really means. As a church staff member, someone who doesn't pray well in her own words, this prayer she writes could not have been more real for me. This is from her book. I thought I'd read it to you guys. I consider it a daily prayer now. Dear God, I just hate everyone right now. If you don't remove this anger and resentment, I'll never get through this liturgy. Please, 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 I beg you. Please help me. For most of us, that is our daily prayer. Along with a few other life-changing events this year, Nadia has shown me the beauty and vulnerability and humility in church leadership with a beautiful perspective. So this is also from her book. This one really touched my heart. This community, she's speaking to new members, I believe, at her church. This community will disappoint them. It's a matter of when, not if. We will let them down, or I'll say something stupid and hurt their feelings. I then invite them on this side of their inevitable disappointment to decide if they'll stick around after it happens. If they choose to leave when we don't meet their expectations, they won't get to see the grace of God, which can come in and fill the holes left by our community's failure. And, well, that's just too beautiful to miss. So, as a friend once told me, your story is an important one. So thank you for sharing your story of grace. And it's my pleasure to introduce to you Reverend Nadia Bowles Weber.
Hi. How are you? Pretty good. So I want to just kind of figure out who's in the room. So I like to get a sense of where you guys are coming from. So raise your hand if you're UCC. If you go to a UCC church, raise your hand. Okay, Methodist, do we have Methodists here? A few. Presbyterians, got some Prezies. Any Episcopalians? Yeah, and Catholics? Yeah, welcome, welcome. And the Lutherans, who are Lutherans? Those are my people. Yeah, welcome. And then Disciples of Christ, DOC folks? Okay, welcome. Baptists, any Baptists here? Not even American Baptist? No? Oh, hi, welcome. Who am I missing? Unitarians. Got a couple of you guys, welcome. I worked at a Unitarian summer camp for 5 years called Roe in Massachusetts, where I had a lot more fun than I should have. Anybody else I missed? Anybody who's like not a church person? Like not... Welcome. Very, very welcome. Thank you for coming. Anyone else? Mormons? Seventh-day Adventists? Ah, welcome. Hi. Who else?
Nazarene.
Nazarene. Welcome. Gosh, you guys are a mix. What else? Am I missing? Non-denominational. Evangelicals or non-denoms? Awesome. It's funny. I was just, I mean, I am like a mainline Protestant pastor, and today I was talking to another Lutheran, and I said, God, I feel like I'm like mainline Protestantism's dominatrix right now. Like, if, like, just work with me on this. I feel like basically I get paid to show up and look kind of exotic, you know, a little edgy and exotic, and then I do things and say things that are kind of painful to people, and I'll say stuff about how the church isn't doing well and why it's not doing well, and they'll be like, oh, that hurts. Say something else. Oh, that one hurts too. So it's like, so I feel like it's almost like I'm mainline Protestantism's dominatrix right now. So, all legal though. I had a friend who wrote a brilliant memoir. Oh, if you have not heard me speak, I really just start talking about whatever I start thinking about. So it's not very linear, or I don't have like the 5 points I'm going to get through tonight or anything like that. So we'll do a lot of Q&A so that you guys can determine which direction I start talking. All that is to say, I had this friend who wrote Melissa Phoebos wrote this brilliant memoir called Whip Smart. I don't know if anyone's read it. She was interviewed on Terry Gross's Fresh Air. But it was a memoir about her being a dominatrix for 5 years in New York while she was high on heroin and an honors student at the New School. And the reason this is coming full circle to just 1 minute ago. The reason I know Melissa Phoebos, and I'm very good friends with her to this day, is she was my camper for 3 years at Roe Unitarian Camp. See what I did there? Okay, so I'm going to just start by just doing a little bit of just kind of cultural theory stuff to talk about why we're finding ourselves in the place that we're in right now in mainline Protestantism in America. So I'm going to be a complete hack cultural theorist for a minute to try and get us to the point where we are now so we can talk more about where we are now. And I'm going to do that by talking about a couple things, namely authority and what do we think has authority. And what did we used to think had authority? And why is that an issue in the church? Because Phyllis Tickle will say to you that what is the locus of authority is the question of postmodernity. That's the question. Did anybody see the picture of me and Phyllis dressed as each other? Did you guys see that? Phyllis Tickle's, how old is she? 80? She's going to be 80 next week? Is that right? Yeah. Okay. She's old. And she... She and I have done a lot of speaking together over the years here and in the UK, and we're good friends. And we dreamed for years about doing a photo shoot where we're dressed as each other. So finally, at this conference a few weeks ago at Christianity 21, we pulled it off. And I got the sleeves that Eric had that makes it look like you have sleeve tattoos. So she had those on, and one of my t-shirts, and my belt buckle, and jeans and boots. And I had on her orthopedic shoes and like a long skirt and a cardigan. And we're like standing like right next to each other dressed as it was a dream come true. So she'll tell you, she's brilliant, she'll tell you that really the locus of authority, that's what the question is in postmodernity. So just really quick, the thing that had authority in pre-modern times was really what your parents and grandparents and great-grandparents told you, what tradition had to say. What came before is what you could rely on. And there's a reason for that, because you were basically born and died within, you know, a few miles, right? So the situation of your life in pre-modernity pretty much mirrored the situation of your parents, your grandparents, your great-grandparents' lives. So what they said had authority because it was super reliable, right? Things didn't change much during this period of time. This is broad strokes. Then we enter modernity, which is right after what we call the Enlightenment. And the Enlightenment was this time where all of a sudden it was the advent of the scientific method. We had a different way of understanding our world that we could verify through the scientific method. And there are these things that came out of the Enlightenment now that we had a different way of understanding things. Now what had authority after the Enlightenment in what we call modern times was anything that was new, that was inventive, that we had just sort sort of discovered. We were in love with discovery at this point. And there were a lot of promises during this time in what we called the Age of Progress. We even named it the Age of Progress. We're going to be going really far now because we understand our world in a different way. So what had authority was what was new and what you could verify through the scientific method. So what happened in this Age of Progress is there were all these promises now during this era, and many wonderful things came out of the Age of Progress. Penicillin's awesome. The United States of America is a product of the Enlightenment. We have hospitals. Those are a product of the Enlightenment. Like, there are some really great things that came out of this. But in order to deliver on these promises, because we're very, very clever now as a human species, we had to develop institutions. So what you see are the advent of institutions that are designed to develop, to sort of distribute these promises of the Enlightenment, of this Age of Progress. So you have the United States government, you have hospitals, you have denominations. Those are institutions that are, they're going to deliver spirituality, right? Hospitals or healthcare systems, they're going to deliver health. Public school systems are a product of the Age of Progress. Here's an institution, it's going to deliver education. And we really did make good on a lot of these promises. But eventually, culture shifted again, and what we began to realize, because now what's true is whatever the institution tells you about what you should be doing for health. This is why in the 50s and 60s women stopped breastfeeding. From the dawn of time, women have fed their babies that they birthed out of their bodies with their own bodies. This is the way humanity has existed. And now you have an institution, you have food production institutions and hospitals saying, actually, this is the Age of Progress. We can develop a product that will improve on what God has created humanity to do to nourish their own infants, right? So you have a whole generation of women who didn't breastfeed because the institution told them what to believe. Okay, so what happened when culture started shifting in modernity is we started realizing that the institutions were more concerned with preserving themselves than they were with delivering the promises of the Age of Progress, right? This is when we have Watergate, and all of a sudden we're more and more cynical about government and it preserving itself. We have clergy sex scandals. All of a sudden we realize, wait a minute, why is it that we are ranking so low with the rest of the world in education? We start thinking, wow, we're a little cynical about our education system. So when this happens, all of a sudden human experience now has an authority it never had before. Never. Never before has human experience had the authority it does now, right? So here's why. Do you guys have Kaiser Permanente here? Oh, it's like a HMO or like a, it's like a healthcare system or whatever. So in Denver, the radio market is saturated with Allison Janney from the West Wing talking about Kaiser Permanente. And she gets on, she goes, Kaiser Permanente cares about the fact that we really want you to have 8 hours of sleep a night. And are you getting enough hugs? And how's your diet? Like, oh, just everything she says is like, Kaiser Permanente, they care about my happiness. They care about my hug ratio. There's all these things that this institution cares about. Okay, so if the institution's giving you this message, and then you try to get your health care through Kaiser Permanente, now, I don't know about them. I can't say they're bad or good or whatever. It's just an example. And your experience is different. Which are you going to trust now? Right? You're going to trust your experience. You're a little bit cynical about the institution. So now we have a whole generation or a whole population that's cynical about institutions and cynical about presumed authority. But they trust their experiences in a way that humanity never really has to tell them things, right? So my question is, what's the role of the church now if this is the case, right? Because the church is an institution. Now, just because this population is cynical about institutions does not mean that they don't want what the institution promised to begin with. We still want healthcare. We still want public education. We still want even religious communities. But there's this whole population that's not really showing up to church, right? So you can look at that data and go, here's an example, phone booths. Phone booths used to dot the landscape of America. Did they not? They were everywhere? Phone booths were everywhere. Okay, so I defy you to tell me where a phone booth is. You know one? You know, like, one, right? And it's, like, ironically there. It's, like, in the hipster neighborhood, right? And so you can look at that data and make this conclusion. Wow, it's really sad that people don't care about communicating with others through phones anymore. Right? False. The desire, the need is still the same. People still want to communicate with other people. The delivery method is totally changed. So what I think is that I think people still want to have spiritual community. I think people still want spiritual leaders. They want people who they feel like can have authority. It's just their experience is more important than it ever has been in two different ways. One, how they experience a leader makes so much more difference than if that leader has a certain title or a certain degree. Like, that piece that, like, that I'm ordained is not nearly as important as the fact that they experience me to be the same person consistently in every place they see me, right? That has a lot more authority to them that I don't have my, like, well, now I have my pastor persona and my pastor voice, and then I'm a totally different person somewhere else. So their experience is what is important. The other way in which experience, oh, my other example, there's the phone booth one, and then there's one that I got from Charles Lee, which is Blockbuster, right? Blockbuster was one of the most successful companies in America for a long time. They nailed it, right? Now, you can't go, oh, wow, Blockbuster, what a joke. No, you can't. That was a very success. They knew exactly what they were doing. They had a corner on the market. They nailed it, right? So you can look at the fact that there are no more Blockbuster stores and say, wow, it's really sad that people don't want to watch movies in their homes anymore, right? Well, no, they clearly still do. It's just the delivery method has changed. So I guess I just hesitate to look at the data in American mainline Protestantism and see the fact that our congregations are graying. Do you guys have denominational magazines? Like, we have the Lutheran magazine. Do you guys have an equivalent in your denomination? I don't know about you, but, like, it feels like every other month the cover of the Lutheran's like, we're almost dead. Like, we got like 20 minutes tops. You know? Right? I mean, we know the data, like the congregations are graying, and if you project the demographic out 15 years, it's dead, right? So there's this institutional anxiety about that. And I understand, I mean, I'm not trying to be dismissive of it. I understand why that's true, and I think that is a reality. I don't think it's because people are uninterested in hearing the gospel. I don't think it's because people are uninterested in being in spiritual communities. I don't think it's because people are uninterested in having somebody who pastors them. I just think the delivery method has changed. And I think it's going to continue to change. Now, we can kind of rend our clothing and cover ourselves in ashes about that, or we can just sort of go, huh, that's really, let's have some curiosity about it. So the other way in which human experience is important in a way that it never has been before is this. I think that people are very interested at this point in having what I call more of a whole life faith, meaning I don't know that they're interested in spending 1 hour a week in a context that has nothing to say about what happens in the rest of the week. I don't know how interested people are in that. So I think that there's a way in which the church is uniquely poised to speak to what people's experiences are personally in their lives and what they're experiencing collectively in the world. And I think sometimes we don't take that seriously enough. And I have a few examples of the way that can actually look. And one is that the Sandy Hook. So a lot of times people have this, like, we're experiencing what I call, like, shared trauma. Like, some horrible thing happens in the world, a tsunami or an earthquake or a school shooting. And we're all collectively traumatized by that. Like, we're seeing it in the news. Our kids are upset. We're talking about it. I mean, it's just weighing on us. We've all had that. We're sharing that. And it feels like It seems to me like one of three things happen in mainline Protestant churches after something like that. One, nothing happens. It's not mentioned at all. Two, maybe you download a formal prayer off the denomination's website and read that during the, add that to the prayers of the people that you also downloaded from the denomination's website. Or three, the pulpit becomes a soapbox politically for wherever the pastor's at on whatever issue this happens to, environmentalism or gun control, whichever side they're on. And I actually reject all three of those out of hand. I don't know that those are the best responses that the church could have during this time. But here's an example of something that we tried, that we found was really effective. When Sandy Hook happened, that was like Christmas season, was it? Was it like right before or right after Christmas? Right before. And I actually heard people saying, I just don't feel like I can even celebrate Christmas. Like, we were all traumatized by that image. Even just the thought of those kids. I mean, just like, even just thinking about it now, it is horrific. We all shared that. And so I felt like I heard people saying, I just don't want to celebrate Christmas. And then I also was hearing this cultural Christianity thing going on where people were lamenting the fact that people aren't saying Merry Christmas and instead they're saying Happy Holidays, and you know, that people just, Christianity doesn't have a foothold that it used to have. And I realized that we were about to have our service of lessons and carols. It's a very traditional liturgy that you do at Christmas time, where there's seven lessons and seven carols. It's we usually do it the first Sunday of Christmas, which means the first Sunday after the day of Christmas, which means the pastor doesn't have to write a sermon. So this is why we do it. And so what I realized was that there is a text that is not included in Seven Lessons and Carols that is a Christmas text. And that is the slaughter of the innocents. And so I realized, so we added it, very intentionally added it. Very simple thing, right? But we added it because I thought the danger of biblical literacy is not putting the shepherds and the wise men together in the manger scene. It's not knowing to place Herod there. So our sacred story has a lot in it that can be always connected to things that are going on in our lives and things that are going on in the world, so that we as a Christian people can continue to create meaning through that. That's part of our task, is we're collectively creating meaning through connecting what's happening in the text and what's happening in the world and in our lives. And so I feel like that's something that increasingly can happen. And I would say, the more we do it and the better we do it, the more I think people will be compelled to show up. If you're speaking the truth about yourself and about the world and about God and connecting our holy scriptures to all of that in a fairly fearless way, people are compelled by that. In a way they're not necessarily compelled by, let's say, cultural niceness or what I call the Elks Club with Eucharist, right? They're definitely not going to give up a very precious time in their week, which is Sunday mornings, for that. So I don't know that people, it's not that people aren't interested, it's that I think they're interested in actually a very deeper level of engagement than the church has been giving them recently. So my sort of throwdown challenge is that I think we have a generation who is interested in a very deep engagement with these things. And is that what we're doing? I'm going to do a great deal of Q&A tonight because I will just talk about the next thing that comes into my head all night, and that may or may not in any way be interesting or helpful for you or even keep you in your seat. So we're going to move to Q&A, and you can ask me anything, and sometimes I'll talk for 10 minutes after a question. Sometimes it might just be a minute or so, but that way you guys can direct it and it won't be like playing Pong in my head anymore.
So how can the congregations help their leadership do this a little bit more fearlessly, or how can the congregation help with that deepening? Because it can't just come from the leader if it's our experience that we care about. How do we help facilitate that within our own churches?
Yeah, that's a great question. I mean, I think there's there are ways to make this more personal, right? So, for instance, like at house, we right after the sermon in the liturgy is usually the hymn of the day, and the function of the hymn of the day is it allows the gathered people to respond to the word. And so we took out the hymn of the day in our liturgy and replaced it with something that serves the same function, which is called open space, and it's 10 minutes of prayer and response and reflection right after the sermon. And one of the things, it's like everything slows down. And people go into this beautiful sanctuary to pray. There's a prayer station up on the stage that people write prayers of the people. So if they write a prayer and put it in the basket, that's read out loud during the prayers of the people later in the liturgy. The shocking thing is it's not called the prayers of Augsburg Fortress or the prayers of Cokesbury or what have you. They're the prayers of the people. So just having people's voices present in the liturgical space is extremely important. And I'll talk a little bit more about that in a sec. But that's one way in which you're telling people, what do you want to say to God in this moment about yourself or the world or someone else? And then when you have that read in that space, things just get deeper and more real when you give people that opportunity. So having their voices. So the thing about experience, I'm going to talk for a minute now. Just hold on. So the thing about experience is this. One thing we've realized at House is that what we're doing is not that different than other Lutheran churches. How we're doing it is profoundly different. And it's different because of the cultural context we're in. So here's an example. We have a very traditional Lutheran liturgy. Like, we use that old LBW setting 3, like that Gregorian chant setting of the liturgy nobody uses anymore. We always chant the psalm. We always have a confession and absolution. Very traditional. How we do it is very different, and it's different in an intentional way. So if you have this population that walks in already having a sort of suspicion of institutions and a suspicion of presumed authority, like I was describing, if you walk into most worship spaces and you look from the back wall to this wall, generally about a third of the physical space is taken up for the two special people who get to stand up front, and the rest of the people look at the backs of each other's heads facing the two special people. Now, if you come in and you already have, you're suspicious of institutions and presumed authority, just the way the physical space is configured is problematic for feeling comfortable, because I don't know who those two special people are. I don't know why they're special. I don't know them. I have no experience of them, right? So we're in the round. We've democratized the space. So the altar table is quite literally and metaphorically at the center of our shared life together. So there's the altar, and then we're in these circles around it. So we've democratized the space for a couple reasons. One, we're also completely a cappella. So people get to experience actually creating the music that they hear in the liturgy. All of the music that you hear comes out of the bodies of the people who showed up. We don't relegate it to a band, to four or five people, or to an organist. They're creating it. We have a cantor who leads the singing very well, and a choral guild, which is anybody who shows up early to learn the parts, and they sit among the community to hold the singing. And so it's like sitting in the middle of a 200-person choir. I mean, it's like four-part harmony fills the whole room. Everyone just makes it themselves because they're a community of producers and not consumers. So their voices are in the room, right? But their voices are in the room in another way as well, which is that the word liturgy means the work of the people. And we take that very seriously. And so when people come in, there's a basket of our booklets that we have. So we have worship booklets. Okay, let me explain the first time I went to Lutheran church. I didn't put this in the book. The first time I went to a Lutheran church, I had not been to church for 10 years because I hated Christians. And so I was like dating the cute Lutheran boy, and I was like, screw it, okay, I'll just see what it's like. And Lutheran just sounded like exotic to me. I was no idea what that even meant. And so I go, and there's a bulletin thing, and then that had a lot of code on it. Like, it had like words I didn't know, and then code. So, and then there was a celebrate insert that had like one of the prayers was there and then some of the readings. So some things were in this thing that you get from the denomination. And then the other thing would say like Kyrie ELW42, and there were like two different hymnals in front of me. And then another thing would say like Sanctus WOV89. And then I'd open the books, and the smaller numbers were at the bottom of the page, and then later in the book bigger numbers were at the different corner, like in the top of the page. And it felt to me like someone was standing next to me the whole time going, "You don't belong here." For an hour, "You don't belong here." So that was my first experience going to a Lutheran church. I didn't know the code, man. I knew I didn't know the code when I went in, right? And it just magnified that experience every minute that I sat there not knowing what to do. So we put all the liturgy just in a book. And so the bold parts, people said, everyone says, you know, the light parts. Also, we do print the music of the hymns, and we only really sing old sort of early American hymns at our church. And so we don't musically infantilize the congregation by saying, "Well, you know, people don't really read music anymore, so we'll just give them the words." We actually give them the music. Now, I don't read music, but like, I'm pretty sure like if the note goes up, you sing up a little, or I think that's right, right? And if there's a dot after it, it's longer, and a squiggly thing means just hold on a sec. So, like, so we give them the music, because when I go to churches where there's just the words and everyone else knows the tune, and everyone else knows the tune and has the words, and I just have the words, I don't even have a fighting chance of picking up the tune. So we give people a fighting chance because we think that they know if the note goes up, they sing up. So, there's a basket of these booklets at when people come in, but then there's also 15 or 18 of them lined out with all the leadership parts of the liturgy written on them. So there's one that says, you know, confession and prayer of the day, gospel, assisting minister at the Eucharist, communion server, post-communion prayer, benediction, prayer of the day, collect, all that stuff, right? So you can walk in, having never been there before, and be like, "I'll read the gospel," right? So we have people doing things that have never been in the room before, and their voice is saying the holy things in the liturgy because we trust that. We are more interested in having their voice in the room than we are in having the best people at saying the things say the things, right? So we say we're anti-excellence, pro-participation. We don't really care about it being done well as much as we care about it being done by everyone collectively. So they get to actually have the experience of being trusted to say the really sacred things in our space together. So we're not doing it. We're doing things differently, but they're the same things. Yeah, okay.
One of the things we're struggling with, I think, in institutions across the board is getting people to make commitments to things that they don't always like.
Yes.
You know, they don't like the music, yeah. They don't like the order of things, sure. And, you know, we're literally in a like culture, right? Mm-hmm. It's one of the trends, this consumerism, we sort of like it, and if we don't, we right. take our persons and our money and move, right. And I'm wondering, how do we get to the depth of commitment, you know, where people are willing to put up with some things yeah. that they don't like because there's a bigger goal in mind?
Yeah. That's a really hard question. And I think there really is a generational reality to that as well. I think what we see as being commitment really looks a certain way in the church for a long time. And I think that then we want to sort of overlay that onto another generation and go, "Why aren't you committed?" But I think that if we sort of have enough curiosity about how this population's different, then the way we run things can change so that they can participate in leadership as well. And what I mean by that is, I was explaining this earlier when I talked to a few Lutherans, is that we don't have a committee system at House, right? Most churches are really run by, somebody actually asked me, How do you balance being a pastor of a congregation and being a mom? And I said, "Oh, because I spend most of my evenings at home." You know why? We don't have a committee system, right? I get to have a life with my family. So the thing about the committee system is that really worked culturally for a long time to run a church. But now what happens is there's really only one type of person who thinks being on a committee is a great idea, right? It's a very particular type of person. Like, these are people you need in the church, for sure, right? But the thing is that's one type of person. And what you're not going to maybe get are cultural creatives or people under 25 or people who work two jobs or whatever, right? So there's a way in which we have selected for one type of person to be the people who get to make decisions for the congregation. That doesn't feel healthy even to me. And so we have a really high level of, we're like a high commitment, low obligation church. People are very committed, but it doesn't look like having these sort of ongoing obligations. So when you get to start a church in this cultural context, you get to establish the DNA so that it's easier. So we just really were lucky to get to establish it this way. So here's an example. 2 weeks ago, we had a Liturgy Guild meeting. Well, there's no such thing as the Liturgy Guild. It doesn't exist. Liturgy Guild is whoever shows up when I say, let's have a Liturgy Guild meeting. It's not even like always the second Tuesday. It's literally when I remember to have them, you know? And so I said, let's have a Liturgy Guild meeting to plan Ash Wednesday and the Sundays in Lent. And 20 people voluntarily spent 2.5 hours of their Saturday to plan Ash Wednesday and the Sundays in Lent, including 3 people who had never been to an Ash Wednesday service in their entire life, right? If you have a committee system, I guarantee you are not going to have people who have never been to an Ash Wednesday planning liturgy, right? So if I went and said to the community, here's what I need. I need 8 people to be on a standing committee. It's the second Tuesday of every month. It's a 2-hour meeting. It's a 2-year commitment. I'd have 0 people. No people. If this is the model where we're like, this is what we need and this is what commitment looks like, I wouldn't have any. So if I'm willing to give up 2 things, which are predictability and control, which, don't get me wrong, is not easy, because every time I'm like, oh my God, are they going to show up? Or who's going to show up? Or what if it's someone with really stupid ideas? You know, I mean, there's... But also, we don't nice each other to death, which I think is sometimes a fault of churches as well. Like everybody has to look at hideous banners for the entire season of Lent because no one could break it to Agnes that they're ugly. They just aren't working. So because nobody's going to like go, hey, those don't really work for us. You can do it in a kind way. You don't have to be, I'm not suggesting let's be unkind, but there's a way in which nobody wants to do that because it's just not nice. And so then everyone's forced looking at really hideous banners for the whole season. Why is that helpful for the whole community? So there does take a particular type of leadership to be able to facilitate this more open source type of process for liturgy. So what was the question? I wanted to get to it. Commitment. Okay, but then there's also, you know, this is a generation that grew up with choose your own adventure stories. They get to decide how their storybooks ended. I didn't get that. Do you know what I mean? Like, there's a way in which they are affecting content in their lives all the time. They're affecting their environment and their content constantly in their life. And then they go to church, and they don't get to do that. So on one hand, I think that it's really good to have this message that church is absolutely for you. It's just not always about you, right? So your voice can be in the room with the liturgy. You have an opportunity to come and affect some of the creative stuff when we're planning it. There's a way in which them being in the room matters, that they aren't just sort of passively consuming a religious product that some experts decided was what they wanted, right? And so what we found, I have a theory, I can't prove it, but I have this theory that because people are trusted with their voice being in the room, like because they can show up and like be the assisting minister at the Eucharist, no questions asked. They don't have to be the right kind of person. Because they're trusted with that, I think they much more naturally take leadership in the rest of the life of the church too. I think it translates that way. They're used to them being there mattering. It matters in the singing. It matters in the liturgy. We can see each other because we're in the round. We actually know who's there because we can see each other really well. So I think they're used to their presence mattering, and then that translates into them taking on ownership and sort of leadership in the community. People start things and groups and events and stuff all the time at my church that sometimes I don't even know until it's over, right? I mean, they just do stuff. And they don't check with me, or they don't wait for me to do it. I mean, they'd be waiting a long time because I'm not doing stuff for them they can do for themselves. So,
I need a little advice because for Lent, I am going to have to give a sermon in front of the whole congregation, and I don't really know what to write about.
Mm. What text are you preaching on? Check that first. That's number one. do you have a sign? Are you at a church that like has assigned texts for each Sunday where like those are the ones you're preaching on? The lectionary?
Well, it's about acceptance, about I have sort of an idea. I'm a Navy brat. I've moved a lot in my life. And my dad finally retired, so this is supposed to be where we stay. Mm. And I feel like I need to be accepted in my church.
Mm. Because you're staying here. You don't get to just get out in a few months.
No.
Mm-hmm. Well, I can tell you a little bit about the process. I don't know what you should preach about, but I can tell you a little bit about my process as a preacher. It's never once been easy, ever, no matter how many times I do it. So if it's not easy, you're probably doing it right. It doesn't mean you're doing it wrong. Whatever text it is that you're given to preach on, try and look at the thing that you don't want to look in the text. If there's something that makes you uncomfortable, or that feels like it hits too far to home, or that it is bringing you to a question that you don't want to answer, then and if there's something you want to ignore, definitely focus on that in the text. Thirdly, you have to be in there somewhere. Like, it has to actually, there has to be a cost in a way. Like, you have to be present in whatever you're saying for it to have any kind of weight or power. And so I describe preaching. Do you know the story of Jacob in the Bible? Okay, are you just saying that because I'm a pastor and you don't want to admit you don't? Yeah. So he wrestled with an angel, like his name was Jacob, and it was changed to Israel, and he wrestled with this angel, and then he asked for a blessing. He wouldn't let the angel go until he asked for a blessing, and then he walked away with a limp. This is what it's like to be a preacher, is that I have this wrestling match between me and the text, and I take my whole community into this, because I'm carrying their stories. I know their stories, and I know what's going on in their lives, and I carry them into this wrestling match between me and the text. And I do not walk away from that text before demanding from it a blessing for my community. And when I walk away limping every time. There's a cost to doing this process. So find out what the blessing is. There has to be some good news, right? There has to be some good news. And so your job, if you're preaching, is to figure out what the good news is. But generally, the only way for that good news to have any weight is to be really honest about what the bad news is first. It's kind of that process. So good luck. You're going to do great. Okay.
You mentioned earlier that at one point in your life, you described that you hated Christians. How did you get from that point to being who you are today?
Oh, I haven't. No. Oh, I'm sorry. Sorry if I misrepresented myself. Well, I wrote a book about that. I mean, honestly, I think that's kind of the story I end up telling in Pastrix. It really is not something I had ever set out to do. I really thought I would never have anything to do with Christianity again in my whole life. But it's like, okay, so like I have this, one of my parishioners, one of the women who started the church with me, amazing, queer woman who was like raised Unitarian, and she's amazing. Her name is Andy, and the church has been around for like a year. And she texted me, and she goes, "Hey, I need some pastoral care, Rev." And I was like, "Cool." So we met her. I met her for coffee, and I go, "So what's going on?" She goes, "Well, I think I'm having a crisis of faith." And I'm like, "What does that look like for a Unitarian? I have no idea." But okay. So she said, "I'm having a crisis of faith. I think I believe in Jesus." I was like, "Oh, you're screwed." But sometimes Jesus just hunts your ass down and there's nothing you can do about it. That's my experience. I didn't think, I think I'll give this Christianity thing another try. I think it would just be a wonderful self-improvement plan for me. And I just, no. So, oh my God, in a Q&A a couple weeks ago, someone said, "Hey, Nadia, so what do you do? What do you personally do to get closer to God?" Like, before I even knew I was saying it, I was like, "What? Nothing. Why would I do that?" That sounds like, I wish the guy would leave me alone half the time. That sounds like a terrible plan. Oh, what can I do to get closer to God? No. This is something that just hunts me down over and over again. It just has never felt like something I've pursued. It's pursued me.
Do we need the church?
I love that question. Do we need the church?
By the way, I'm a United Church of Christ pastor.
Okay, so I'll measure my answer. It depends how you define church. Do we need Elks Club with Eucharist? Probably not. I don't know. Probably not, I'd say. Some people like it, but I think they're not going to be around for a long time. So it depends how you define church. So when people say to me, "Oh, the church is dying. The church is dying." I'm like, well, define church. Okay. So I think there are ways in which the church in America, this is going to hurt, has bought into corporate American values in a way we never had any business doing to begin with. What I mean is that I think that we define success. We define success for ourselves with a set of values that really is imported from consumerist American capitalist value system in a way that we're not even aware of anymore. Like, do we need the fancy stuff and the impressive this and the really awesome that, right? I mean, we have to ask, like, what value system does that come from? Because there are ways also in which I think the church has replicated things that actually the culture does well. Like, the culture does rock music well. Church never doesn't really need to do that, right? I mean, the church, the culture does probably counseling pretty well, preschool. Not saying there's something wrong with having a Christian trademark in churches doing these sort of external things, but I wonder the way in which we have to say, look how sort of relevant in the space that we deserve to take the space up because we're doing these things well. Well, those are increasingly more and more difficult to do well because of shifts in culture. Here's the thing. What the culture will never do, ever, is preach the gospel, administer the sacraments, and declare forgiveness of sins. You know why? That's our job. That's our only job when it comes down to it, right? So to me, church, this is me and Martin Luther, is that, in all fairness, church is wherever the sacraments are rightly distributed and the word of God is proclaimed and forgiveness of sins is proclaimed. That's church. So when people say the church is dying, do they mean that people will no longer gather in the name of the triune God and tell the story about the night Jesus was betrayed and hold up bread and wine and tell each other, "This is for the forgiveness of sins and it's for you"? Do we really think that, yep, that's definitely not going to be happening 20 years from now? I don't think so. God's not going to allow that. I really believe that God's not going to allow that. But the way in which we've determined what success looks like and how it must be done and all of that is probably going by the wayside.
actually have two questions. My first question is, I'm a member of this church, and we just finished our series on the Great Convergence with with a sermon on bringing other faiths into, not just like moving away from like the where we've sort of been at, which is like the niceties and the tolerances of other faiths, specifically like Judaism and Islam as part of the Judeo-Christian mm-hmm. combination, and actually delving into like a real deep conversation and seeing where we can connect and find common ground, because we are, there's movements towards those more sort of honest and genuine and deep explorations of faiths in those mm-hmm. sects. And so I was interested to see if you had any thoughts about that. And two, can we be best friends?
You don't want to be best friends.
I do. And I would totally move to Denver if you said yes.
So we've seen and we have a lot of experience in the ways in which religion caused division, right? Just everywhere. Wars, division, blah, blah. I mean, we just see it everywhere. And I think that there's not a lot of future in that. But any way in which religion does the opposite, any way in which religion can bring together, can sew together, can mend, can heal, there's a future in that. There's definitely a future in that. So that's going to look different in lots of different contexts. But I think we have to start thinking like that more and more. I mean, even just the fact that, like, we're in an Episcopal church. Like, House for All Sinners and Saints is a Lutheran church, but we're in an Episcopal church. So any amount of sort of ecumenism, interfaith stuff, any way in which religion can do the opposite of what it's done for so long, I feel like there's a big future for us in that. But, like, having said that, let me just clarify. I am not a post-denominational person. Some people are. They're like, oh, that denominations, we gotta... I think our particularities are beautiful, and I think that they're to be honored and preserved, actually. And I think that there's a way to have a sort of robust ecclesiology that says, look, you know what? Maybe the Episcopalians and Lutherans and the Catholics have sort of caretaken that deeply liturgical sacramental tradition on behalf of the whole body. Maybe the Anabaptists have caretaken the Peace Church tradition on behalf of the whole body. Maybe Presbyterians have preserved this way in which, hey, the way in which we are church together matters in a really particular way. They've caretaken that on behalf of the whole body. So I think that there's a way in which we can appreciate the oneness without losing the particularity.
Yeah, Nadia, you talked about your worship services at House for All Sinners and Saints. What about other ministry going on there?
Sure.
What sort of things happen?
Outside of Word and Sacrament,
yeah.
Is that what you're saying? Okay, this takes me a while. Like, it's hard for me to remember because I'm not involved in most. But we have a thing called Supper Clubs, which is groups of 6 to 10 people that meet every other week to share a meal and check in with each other for a three-month period, and then they switch around. So it's a way for people to be connected. Where there are a lot of social workers in our community, a lot of people who are really holding the most broken realities of the world during the week, who are dealing with, who are counselors for rape victims, who work with homeless youth, pregnant teenagers. I mean, they're doing serious direct care, and they realized that they had some really particular needs that could be met by each other. And so they decided to make a group. And so once a month, they share a meal and check in with each other and support each other. We have a catechumenate that I teach, an adult confirmation catechumenate program. There's usually 20 or more people in that program when that's taught. We have morning prayer. There's a small group that sings matins every Wednesday together. There's two different contemplative prayer groups that meet during the week. We have a community garden that we do with St. Thomas that all the produce goes to the food bank. We have wacky things we do, like, you know, we do the beer and hymns and theology pub and blessing of the bicycles. This Tuesday is our seventh annual Fat Tuesday celebration. And that's Fat Tuesday originated, that's what Mardi Gras is, carnival, right? A farewell to meat. So in medieval Europe, they weren't allowed really to eat meat and fat and sugar and stuff during Lent. And so the day before Lent started, they would clean out their larders and have big community parties to get it all out of their house. That's the history behind that. And so every year we go to a bar and just hand out donuts all night to celebrate Fat Tuesday. And then we also have these 40 ideas for keeping a holy Lent that we give people if they're interested. And we also give them postcards that are stamped and addressed to Post Secret, which is this art project where people write their secrets and they mail them to this guy, and he publishes them on a blog and in a book and stuff. And so we give these to people saying, in case they want to confess their sins before Lent starts the next day. And so that's a tradition. I mean, we just do weird, we do whatever we feel like. I mean, it just sounds weird, but we don't do things we feel like we should do. We just do things that feel natural for us as a community. And, you know, the first year as a church planter, I'd come up with a lot of these wacky ideas. And to me, I thought, okay, we're going to do all these events, Blessing of the Bicycles and Theology Club and Beer and Hymns and Operation Turkey Sandwich is this other thing we do. And I thought, okay, and then people will see what a cool church we are, and then they'll totally come and join us on Sundays. And I did most of the work because it was a new church and I was a church planter, so I just like killed myself doing all this work, and I thought, but it's going to be worth it because people are going to show up to church. And after a year of having all these events, approximately zero people came on Sunday for liturgy as a result. Now, people in the community loved them. They loved the way they engaged in them. They participated. The people in our church loved it. And I thought, oh my gosh, I'm a failure. I'm a failure as a church planter. This whole thing has been a failure. I was wrong about all this. And literally, all of a sudden, I thought, wait a minute, what if all that stuff we do is just an end? And it's not a means to an end. And then in a moment's time, it all went to being successes. Every single thing we did was a success. As soon as I realized, what if they're just an end and not a means to an end? And so we do a lot of stuff at church that's really, people are like, why do you do it? We're like, I don't know, because we like it. Like, it's not, you know, a lot of times we have things that are like evangelism program. It's like evangelism. Oh, you mean church growth strategy? Because you're tired of sitting on the committees and paying on all the bills, and you just want to recruit more people to do that because you don't want to do it anymore. Don't call it advance. Fine. If church growth, fine. No problem with that. Just don't call it evangelism, right? So we were doing these things thinking, oh, this is church growth strategy. So when we stopped that, we're like, no, it's not. We just do the stuff. Oh, it was so much more fun then. It was just much more fun.
Okay, we're going to stop with the questions right now so we can give Nadia a break. Did you have anything else you wanted to?
I have many other things I could say.
Okay, we'll stop you too. Okay, let's give Nadia a hand and tell her thank you.
Thanks. Thank you. Appreciate it.
You've been listening to a lecture program from the Center for Faith Studies on Noon Forum. We've heard a talk by Nadia Bowles Weber, the founding pastor of House for All Sinners and Saints in Denver, Colorado, and author of Salvation on the Small Screen, 24 Hours of Christian Television. The topic of her talk, also the title of her latest book, was Pastrix, The Cranky Beautiful Faith of a Sinner and Saint. This program was recorded by Omaha Public Radio on Thursday evening, February 27, 2014, for broadcast at this time. Special thanks to Leslie Morrell, former interim director of the Center for Faith Studies, for helping to make the recording and broadcast of this program possible. Complete Noon Forum listings, as well as an archive of over 400 previous broadcasts, are available on our website, kios.org. Now, this is your producer and host, Bob Coate, thanking you for listening.